From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're joined by film director Kenny Riches and actor Patrick Fugit, who are in town for a commemoration and fundraiser celebrating the life of Salt Lake actor, writer, musician, and artist David Fetzer, who passed away unexpectedly last year at the age of 30.
David was always a very talented theater actor, and I could get up and I could ham-bone my way through some theater, but I didn't have what David had on the stage, and that was very clear. And watching him perform and watching the way people reacted to him was also a really important building block for me, and it also established David as a sort of sounding board for me.
That conversation and your summary of the day's top local headlines coming up next on The Rundown. And thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown here on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later in the show, we're going to have a conversation about the Salt Lake actor and artist David Fetzer and the new foundation that bears his name. But first up, we have these headlines. West Valley City Police say a knife-wielding man shot three times by an officer on Sunday night is in the hospital in critical condition. Deputy Chief Mike Powell says police were called Sunday night to 3200 West and 3500 South, where a man was walking with a knife. Powell says the man threatened an officer who then fired his gun at the man. Law enforcement officials were still investigating on Sunday. The Deseret News reports that police did not release further details, including details about the man's identity. A Utah federal judge struck down parts of Utah's anti-polygamy laws as unconstitutional on Friday. The ruling is a victory for polygamous families, including plaintiff Cody Brown and his family. Brown and his four wives are featured on the popular TLC reality show Sister Wives. KCPW's Ryan Cunningham has more.
In a ruling released on Friday, U.S. District Judge Clark Waddups found that Utah law restricting cohabitation was in violation of the First Amendment, which protects religious freedom. In the decision, the judge reasons that Utah has, quote, no rational basis, unquote, to ban religious cohabitation as practiced by polygamous sects. He did, however, uphold the state's prohibition of legal bigamy, narrowly defined as when one person obtains two marriage licenses. The case was brought to court by television star Cody Brown and his four wives, Mary, Janelle, Christine, and Robin Sullivan. Mary Brown is Cody's legal spouse. The Brown family is one of the more public polygamous families, starring in their own reality show, Sister Wives, which has featured on TLC since 2010. Ann Wild of Principal Voices, a polygamy advocacy group, cheered the ruling. She says that the decision, should it stand up to the appeal process, could mean more equality for those in plural marriages.
I got a call not too long ago from somebody who had married a man in full marriage, but she had been married before and had two children, and the ex-husband was holding over her head the fact that she couldn't have legal custody because she was a plural wife. Now, legally, that will not hold water anymore. I mean, he can threaten her, but at least they're on more equal footing legally about getting custody of those children.
With polygamy effectively legal, Wild says polygamists won't have to live in the shadows anymore.
Because there's no way, for right now at least, and hopefully permanently, that they can step in and take away people's children or arrest a man for having more than one wife.
Not just polygamists are in favor of Judge Waddup's decision. Karen McCrary of the ACLU in Utah believes the judge ruled correctly on the basis of protecting religious freedoms.
I think that the court found the statute does not apply equally to everyone, instead criminalizes cohabitation between consenting adults only when it's done for a religious purpose. So, you know, singling people out based on their religious beliefs in this way is wrong and unconstitutional.
The Utah Attorney General's office has not yet decided whether it will appeal the ruling, but because this was only a partial ruling on the plaintiff's suit, there will be ample time for the Attorney General's office to determine how to proceed. The Apostolic United Brethren, a polygamous church in Bluffdale with ties to the Brown family, was reached by phone on Monday, but the call was disconnected after requests for comment. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
Regulators say the owner of a Utah coal mine failed to support the ceiling of a tunnel before it collapsed on a machine operator. The U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration released an investigation Monday into the March collapse that killed 29-year-old Ellum Jones in Carbon County. Jones was crushed by a 7-ton slab of falling sandstone at the coal mine about 10 miles west of Huntington. Accident investigators say Kentucky-based Rhino Resource Partners didn't have enough 60-inch bolts drilled into the ceiling to keep it from falling down, and that the bolts failed. Investigators say the danger should have been clear because the tunnel started caving in sideways first. The report says a mobile roof support system used with mining machines wasn't kept over the active mining area. And those are our top local headlines for the day. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. Today, we're joined by filmmaker Kenny Riches and actor and musician Patrick Fugit to speak about the David Ross Fetzer Foundation for Emerging Artists, a new foundation that makes available grants and provides a mentoring framework to artists 35 and younger for the development of innovative film and theater projects here in Salt Lake City. The foundation was created to honor the legacy of Salt Lake actor, writer, musician, and visual artist David Fetzer after his untimely accidental death last year, the result of a combination of painkillers and alcohol. Fetzer was named one of the Salt Lake Tribune's 8 emerging artists in 2011, and his performances on stage and screen were revered for being quietly authentic and even mesmerizing. Fetzer founded the New Works Theater Machine in Salt Lake in 2010, whose purpose was to create a theater experience for 18 to 35-year-old theatergoers. The Salt Lake Film Festival has named an award in his honor, and we could probably spend the length of this program outlining Fetzer's accolades. Tomorrow night, this new foundation is holding an event at the Tower Theater to honor Fetzer and to raise money for 3 grants for local emerging artists. Kenny Riches is vice president of the foundation's board and a close friend of the actor. He directed Fetzer in the film Must Come Down, which was screened at several film festivals last year. Actor Patrick Fugit is a longtime friend of David Fetzer. Fugit and Fetzer made up the band Mushman, and the creative duo frequently consulted each other on scripts, music, artwork, project ideas, and everything else good friends consult with each other on. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Kenny, maybe you can tell us about tomorrow's event, both in terms of its genesis and its purpose. Why are you guys doing this?
Well, I guess it started as a combination of 2 projects that kind of merged. My short film project and then Betsy, David's mother's, starting this foundation. And we thought, we all love each other. Let's just have it all happen in one awesome event. And yeah, so it'll be an event that kind of highlights David's work as a screenwriter and then also promotes this foundation to help fundraise for emerging artists.
That's great. So there are 2 films that you're showing that David wrote and you have now brought to the screen.
Yeah, like 10 years ago maybe, when David and I lived together, we had writing assignments and all these super nerdy film stuff, going on between us. And we just had a stack of his scripts and thought it'd be an awesome way to carry on his legacy.
And actually, let's get the names of those 2 films. What are they and what are they about?
Oh man, pitching movies is like the worst thing for me.
No,
I suck
really
at it.
Good at it.
Aesop the Warrior is starring Patrick and David's brother Scott Fetzer, who's amazing in it. And it's about these 2 best friends, where one is kind of lost in life and he is looking for something, anything, and his other friend decides for some reason to introduce him to the Bible. And so he decides to go Bible thumping in middle America, where everyone is already. they know what the Bible is, of course. And it's about friendship and failure, I guess.
That sounds great. So he goes out and proselytizes. He's going to go out and
exactly.
Become a missionary. And then the other one is How to Speak Clearly.
How to Speak Clearly, and that's starring Dustin DeFay, who is a filmmaker. David produced his film called Bad Fever a couple years ago. And also starring Lindsay Pulsifer and L.V. Yost, and then other local stage actors, Morgan Lund, Jane Luke, and then Frank Garish, who now lives in L.A., but he's another local actor. And that's about a guy that is in a setup, kind of an arranged marriage through the parents, their business partners.
Okay.
And kind of about miscommunication.
Like, miscommunication, inevitability, speaking and being heard, and like not wanting to listen.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite
and things lost in translation too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like Dustin plays a character who is in this arranged marriage, but has to kind of reevaluate where he is, and it looks very interesting. They both look very interesting. And there's also a silent auction you're going to have to raise money for the foundation, and the money that's being raised is going to fund the grants that will be available for people to apply for if they are interested. Let's get the details. What time is it at, and where?
It is Tuesday night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the Tower Theater on 9th and 9th. You can buy tickets online through the foundation website, which is thedaveyfoundation.org, and Davies, D-A-V-E-Y.
And they're $10, right?
$10, yeah. We're getting near sold out now, so okay. I think it'll be a sellout show.
So, Kenny, I'm gonna stay with you for a second longer and say that you directed David in your feature film from last year, Must Come Down. Maybe you could tell us about that experience and about your perspective on what David brought to the table as an actor and as a performer.
Man, I wish I could talk as fast as you. You speak so fast. I feel like I'm in slow motion. People in Miami say I speak way too slow. What was the question?
what it was like to direct David and there's a lot of accolades. And I remember I've been trying to dig up this City Weekly review from maybe 5 or 6 years ago that called him Utah's best actor, and I don't even remember which stage production it was.
But. Yeah, it's interesting. If after all, each of David's productions that he would do, I would read the reviews, and that was generally the first thing. You know, David is really what makes this production shine. But yeah, working with him on Must Come Down was really awesome, and I don't know. I mean, we have a really tight-knit group of friends, so it was very comfortable and easy to write because I was writing for people I knew. Working with David, he already knew what I wanted. I didn't have to really work much at directing him, which was really
pretty
awesome.
Insane. Also yeah. Considering that his character somewhat carries the film in terms of watchability and everything. So the actor sure. that's cast in that role has to be really reliable in terms of performance and like captivating an audience and being affable and watchable.
The camera has to like them.
Exactly, yeah. And the camera loved David. Mm-hmm. But that also is like a huge thing in itself to be said about David's innate talent, because at that point, I mean, he'd never been given a feature film character yeah. like that as a lead. Mm-hmm. And that's no joke, you know, and he was really good at that. And I think he did it beautifully.
He didn't like to rehearse because he felt that it took away the spontaneity. So he would just get to set, you know, kind of study the scene, rehearse it real quickly with Ashley, and then just go and nail it.
And this Must Come Down was, you kind of made the festival circuit. And is it available now? Can people get it and watch it?
Yeah, it's on DVD and it's streaming through our website through some embedded player. And the next step is iTunes and Netflix and things like that.
Okay.
So that'll be coming up when I have more time to do it.
It's a tough topic, but I'm wondering if we could talk about what we're missing, both in terms of a career cut short, which seems kind of trite to just talk about that, but also obviously from the personal side. David was much more than a writer, an actor, musician, performer, artist. But Patrick, maybe you could talk about the influence David had on your life, both personally and obviously artistically.
From a very young age, it was very clear that David and I cared quite a lot about performance, and we cared quite a lot about theater, film. Music came later, but also humor and stuff like that, which was huge for us. Physical humor, spoken, everything that we could sort of absorb and turn into our own sort of style or light was an opportunity we always took. You know, we would take from Laurel and Hardy and Buster Keaton and Monty Python and The Simpsons and stuff like that, and we started to create a base of reference. And that happened very, very early. That happened when we were like 10, 11, 12 kind of area. And we got a hold of my parents' huge like RCA camera that are like 10 pounds. And like you actually used to put VHS tapes in the camera. Oh. And we used to make films. We used to make the stupidest little short films, or just like we used to just put it on and then fall over in front of it. We'd just fall over and see how funny the falls would be. And David would inevitably end up getting hurt. He would end up missing the pad that we laid out or something like that. But I didn't realize then, and I've realized sort of recently in my adult-ish life, that base layer of taste, basically, between him and I really developed my voice as an actor and my every theme I put into a character or think about in a film or in a scene is with that base layer. And it's always been because when we were younger, David was always a very talented theater actor. And I could get up and I could ham-bone my way through some theater, but I didn't have what David had on the stage, and that was very clear. And so watching him perform and watching the way people reacted to him was also a really important building block for me. And it also established David as a sort of sounding board for me, because I looked up to David. And so I would see what David was doing and I would say, that's great. That's greatness there. Whether it was or not, whether he, you know, like if as an adult we saw these plays and we would go, oh my God. But back then I was like, that's great. And people are reacting to it greatly. And I love it. I'm enjoying it. And I see every bit of David in the performance and I see every bit of the performance in itself. You know, it stands on its own, but it's also a huge part of it is David and his soul going into it. So all of that established David as somebody to look up to artistically for me. And it also established him as my sounding board. So from then on, whenever I would do theater or whenever we would make something or anything, it was, could I make David laugh? Could I make David cry? Could I affect David? And would David like it? The entire time I've been making films, which is like the last 15 years, mm-hmm. I've cared mostly about what my friends, David and my friends, and then what my family thought of the films.
You know, and in an interview you did with the Salt Lake Tribune, you talk about consulting frequently with David on scripts that you would get. Patrick, you are an established Hollywood actor, but you would take the time to run these scripts and other things by David. I mean, is that the kind of relationship you had in that level? Or
yes, but David and I, and we should talk about this because I think it's probably pretty interesting, you and I, Kenny, because the way David and I interacted and communicated was always very like metaphorical and non-linear, non-literal. So I would never really say like, hey, I want your opinion on this. I would just sort of be like, hey, check this out, read it. And then we would sort of laugh about it, or we would just sort of like, you know, it was more like reading his energy. And then sometimes it would be a hard decision for me because there were things that happened creatively, artistically, where I had to make a decision, and I could take what I knew about David and what I know about myself, because we thought very, very similarly in terms of taste and stuff like that. I could most of the time really know what he was going to think about it before. And it wasn't ever really like, hey, you know, should I do this? Should I not do this? Or like, do you like this or do you not like this? Because I already knew the answer to that. It was, what is here? What do you see here? Like, say I was making an audition tape for something really important to me, I would get David and do it because I would come up with my sort of take, which was always as original as I could make it. And then David would infuse his sort of take on top of my take. So I wasn't acting the way David wanted me to act. It was what I had done inspired David to expose more of what I was doing, and then vice versa. And so it was always a really, really nice rapport, really nice collaboration. And my acting was always way better when he was there to critique or direct it.
A trusted sounding board.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's really funny. I was going to mention the audition tapes. It's kind of one of those things where it was almost more important that they were entertaining for us than,
yeah, exactly.
than the directors that you were sending them
to.
Yeah,
we'd make these like really elaborate audition tapes that it's literally you just have to stand there and say the lines, you know, but we would like put like camera moves, we'd put like wardrobe and props. And at one point, David was in it for a Coen Brothers movie, The Lady Killers.
Oh, yeah.
We cut to David at one point. Shoot, dude, we need to find that. We really need to find that. But
that was an audition tape you did for Lady Killers.
Yeah.
We started to talk about kind of his own career getting cut short, and it's a tragedy. And I don't know how you even begin to theorize on this, but what are we missing out on?
Boy, that question comes with a lot of regrets for me, because I was always constantly trying to push him towards doing things and, you know, writing. You know, he was working on a feature film, and I was kind of pushing him hard on that, but there's so many other projects where I feel like I could have helped him bring to reality. I don't know, the whole time we were making the short films, you know, that were going to screen, it was like, oh man, why didn't we just...
Yeah, why didn't we just make them all?
Yeah, why didn't we make them when we had David? But, so I don't know, everyone, right now, you know, he's in the spotlight as far as his creativity being, you know, so amazing and magical, which it was, but he also had, you know, a lot of problems actually like getting going with his own projects because it was so easy for him to, you know, what, Kenny, you're making a film? Yeah, like, let's do everything to make that. And so he would drop what he was doing. So then we would all have to get on him, like push him to do his own stuff. But I don't know, he's quite prolific.
Mm-hmm. And there's a comment on selflessness there, giving yourself over to other people's projects.
For sure.
I wanted to talk about music for a second because David was a great musician. Maybe, Patrick, you can talk about how the band came to be.
So back in 1999, I got a guitar as a present, and then David got a guitar as a present. And we sat down around Christmas time, and we were like, what do we learn? Let's learn Stairway. Let's learn Over the Hills and Far Away. Let's learn Cat Stevens and Simon Garfunkel. And we started out mostly finger style, like finger picking. But we sort of skipped a step, which is usually musicians or guitarists like to learn some songs and then they go get some lessons about theory and song structure and then they start to write their own music. We skipped that and we were learning Cat Stevens and then we would start jamming with each other and we would just start finding the scales and finding the notes. Like, I can't jam really with anybody else. I'm not a very good musician. Like, I can technically play the guitar fairly well, but it was really our rapport that got us started. So we would start playing something and we'd start, you know, expanding on whatever we were playing and we would add little lines to it. There was something very simple about the way we had to play because we weren't great at song structure. We started out very bare in terms of music and then lyrics. From there, we were like, dude, we gotta like record some of this stuff. And we recorded our first album in a closet and we were like, you know, what should we call the band? And we thought about Harvey Mushman, paying homage to Steve McQueen. He used to race motorcycles under the alias Harvey Mushman. And so we were like, well, maybe just Mushman. And then we were like, well, that's good for now. Let's change it later. And then then like we'll come up with something better later. And then we just put it on that album and we had all these kind of little themes. It was like we had very few songs and we had a lot of themes. Then from there, we both started expanding and blossoming, but David much more so than I. I think his natural talent and his natural ability to create these songs and to create these characters and lyrics, because his lyrics were usually about some sort of offbeat character that could be in a children's book or something.
Right.
But ended up being a very dark story about something tragic or tragically funny or sad or whatever. And from there, the music started expanding and we wrote and recorded our second album and started playing around a lot of live shows. And I think we both would get frustrated, particularly David, that we didn't, either of us, really have time to focus wholly on having a band and like maybe going on tour or something. That was always something we talked about, but I mean, I was in Los Angeles quite a bit and David was also torn between like music and writing and acting and theater and everything. So, and like Kenny said, this creativity would sort of flow out of David and it would come out on paper, it would come out on a guitar, or it would come out on stage. And then actually forming that into something like, quote, substantial that you could sell to somebody or that you could actually produce or get produced,
right,
was a step that wasn't as like
we couldn't figure it out yet.
It wasn't familiar to us. So.
Or maybe it wasn't as important. I mean,
there's that too, but yeah, definitely. And I mean, that it was that way with the music and it was that way with acting. He moved out to LA for a while to pursue getting an agent and everything, and LA is an evil place and it gobbled up everything. And he was just so swamped with like paying rent and sort of getting situated out there that he ultimately was like, this is crazy, I'm out of here. And so I think we always wanted to expand the music project and be Mushman, or at least start a new sort of project. We had talked a lot about that, starting a new project with his brother and with my brother. My brother plays drums extraordinarily well. And his brother, of course, Scott Fetzer, is like such an insanely talented musician. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. But we had been talking about that, and I think that was sort of the next step. You know, 2013, we need to get together in LA for like a month and just record by ourselves and just like put together another set of songs and get an album together, something like that.
You know, there's a lot that we're not touching on, and I'm realizing that we're kind of running low on time. You know, he's a visual artist. We talk about his drawings. He had like a comic strip, as a matter of fact.
I don't know. I mean, that's the hard part, is because you want to explain all of David's genius, you know, in a short radio program, but it's just impossible. Yep. You know, I mean, you see his influences everywhere, like his music. You know, you see where he was, what he was influenced by also, you know, like mm-hmm. you see Charlie Brown and Edward Corey and Truffaut in like his music, you know, you see everything kind of blending together, but he also had such his own voice that I think that's what the rest of our group always looked to him for. Mm-hmm. Like when I'm writing, like, oh, what would David do? Like, how can I, you know, because I knew that I would eventually give the script to David and he would take his red pen and just like rip it to shreds.
Obliterated.
Which was, you know, always really exciting for me. It was never like, oh, you know, I suck. It was more like, I suck and David's way better.
Yeah. I mean, it's like we all, I think, innately have that trait, like that sort of understanding and the will to sort of take the steps to connect to that sort of thing, like whether it's humor or something else. But David was sort of a pioneer of the territory, like a completely, yeah.
Like when I'm around Betsy, if, you know, she's like, oh, you know, damn it, that jerk for doing this to us, whatever, it's easy for me to, you know, make a David-style joke to make her laugh, stuff like that.
This is Betsy, David's mom, who I would be remiss in mentioning that she wrote a very powerful cover story in the Salt Lake City Weekly.
Yes. My goodness, sad. Yes.
And I encourage people to check that out should they get a chance. But maybe remind our listeners one more time when this event is, how they can get involved, and how they can find the David Ross Fetzer Foundation.
Yeah, so I encourage playwrights and filmmakers to check it out. And eventually I think it'll spread to other things, you know, visual arts, things like that. But I encourage them to look at the website, thedavyfoundation.org, and it has information on all the grants and deadlines and things like that. But the event is Tuesday night, 7 to 9, at the Tower Theater. We'll screen two films that he wrote, and then one film that, a little short film that Patrick Waldrop directed, which was his co-worker at the Salt Lake Film Society.
Great, yeah. I was going to mention that David worked at the Tower and at the Broadway Center Cinema as well. So it's apropos that this is happening at the Tower Theater.
Yeah, I think that working at, you know, that institution really helped also inform his taste in film. You know, I mean, the Tower Theater has such a great film library. He'd come home with stacks of DVDs and we'd just like veg out, and I think that really helped him.
Great. Kenny Riches and Patrick Fugit, thanks for taking the time to come in here and talk about David, his life, legacy, and this new foundation.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
That was filmmaker Kenny Riches and actor and musician Patrick Fugit speaking about the newly created David Ross Fetzer Foundation for Emerging Artists. You can join them tomorrow night from 7 to 9 at the Tower Theater for their foundation's first annual kickoff to honor Fetzer and support young artists in the community. More information at thedavyfoundation.org. You're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And that's full time for The Rundown today. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation with incoming Salt Lake City Council member Lisa Ramsey Adams from District 7. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in today. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.